Sermons from the Journey is the audio podcast of the weekly message preached by Reverend Becca Gorell, pastor at Lebanon United Methodist Church in Lebanon, New Hampshire, and blogging at pastorbecca.com. Thanks for listening. So as you recall, as you may recall, we are journeying through Lent by looking at the scriptures from the Hebrew Bible and seeing how they detail for us, describe for us the promises, the covenants of God. Now, it's all well and good until we come to a passage that really gives us pause. And this is one of those passages from the Hebrew Bible that really gives me pause. Often when there's a passage that gives me pause, it is from the Hebrew Bible. Because the God pictured there is not always nice, not always the sort of God that I want to worship or want to have anything to do with, it seems. Here we've got a God who, when people complain, sends poisonous snakes to bite them and kill them. Now, I don't like it when people complain, but even I know that you probably shouldn't send poisonous snakes out to, you know, bite those complainers so that they die. And I have a hard time believing that God acts in this way. I do think when we encounter this passage that we see a story that's meant to describe something true, but not necessarily something factual. What is true in this story is that God is delivering. This is the nation of Israel coming out of Egypt, out of their time of slavery, right? And we know this. They've been taken out of the oppression of Pharaoh. But as soon as they hit the wilderness, things don't go as easily as they had imagined they would. And they start to complain. This is a normal human reaction. So that makes sense. And I think what this story means to point to, or is trying to point to, is that we create our own problems. We get ourselves stuck in problems of our own creation. By complaining, the people of Israel bring upon themselves destruction and death. That seems very true to me. By complaining, the people of Israel focus their attention on the things of death and not on the life and liberation that God is trying to put forth in front of them. And that trips us up. We do that as people all the time. We create problems of our own devising and then seem or are helpless to fix them. It's as if, and now this is a story that's not hypothetical, but that I will not necessarily reveal which side of this story I'm on. It's as if we were a young child playing with a roll of scotch tape, and our parents said to us, "Don't unroll all the scotch tape. It's for taping things together. It's not for taping yourself." And yet we unrolled all the scotch tape and we wrapped it so tightly around our hands that our fingers got stuck together and our hands started to really hurt and our fingers started to turn blue. And we went to our parents and we said, "Help, my hands hurt." And they didn't say, "Well, you wrapped the scotch tape around your hands. What did you expect?" They calmly and gently and lovingly cut the scotch tape from our hands and freed us, right? We create these problems of our own volition. We do stuff that gets us in trouble, and then we need a way out of it. Now, Einstein says that no problem can be solved by the same level of consciousness that's created it, right? But by a higher level of consciousness. We create lots of problems. Sure, we wrap ourselves up in scotch tape when we're little. But we create all kinds of problems in our lives. We create all kinds of destruction in the world around us. We, humans, create problems like warfare by our violent actions. We create problems like poverty by our greed. We create problems like climate change by not paying attention to how our use of the world and its resources impacts everyone. We create problems. And then we can't figure out how to solve them. And I think this text points us to that human tendency to having created a problem, then suddenly saying, "Oh, well, now we need God to help us fix it." I don't believe that God is in those problems, that God sends war or poverty or climate change or snakes, but that God is in what happens next. Because what happens next is really remarkable. This story is a lesson in what God's salvation looks like. And God's salvation is subversive. God's salvation takes things and flips them upside down, takes our expectations and turns them upside down and inside out. When the people who have created a problem, who have focused on the ways of death and complaining and destruction instead of on the way of life and liberation that God has sent before him, before them, when the people complain and create a problem, then they cry out to God, and what do they say? They say, take the snakes away. They're still focused on the problem. The problem's now the snakes. The problem was that the desert's not as cozy as the land of Egypt was. Now the problem is the snakes. Take the snakes away. Isn't that what we always pray, really, in one way or another? When we are crying out, when we are struggling, when we are in pain, take this away from us. Take the problem away, O God. Does God take the snakes away? No. God doesn't take the snakes away. Does God make their bites less poisonous? No. Doesn't make the bites less poisonous. People still get bitten by snakes and they still have the potential to die. What God does is God takes the snake and transforms it into an instrument of salvation. This snake, this cause of death and pain and destruction in the community, is going to be the means by which God also offers salvation. Salvation has the same root word in English and in Romance languages as healing, right? We speak of an ointment or a salve. That's the same root word. Or you might know the toast in other languages, salut or sauté, to your health, right? So that's where salvation comes from. And that's why I say, even though we're not talking about spiritual salvation, we're talking about physical health in this case, that God takes this agent of death and destruction and transforms that into a symbol, a means for salvation. That's the way God's salvation works. It is subversive in that way. It takes the things that would be destructive and makes them life-giving. It doesn't remove the snakes or remove the obstacles, but it takes those and flips them on their head, lifts them up instead of removing them, and thereby creates a salvation that we could never create for ourselves, a solution to a problem that we could never create because we've created, in many ways, the problem itself. And so now we see why Jesus compares himself, or compares, from our perspective, the cross to the snake, the serpent in the wilderness. Here is an ultimate symbol, not the begotten Son, not Jesus himself, but the manner of his death, the ultimate symbol of destruction in the time and place where Jesus and his disciples and his followers were living. The Roman authority structure, as deadly and abusive and powerful as Egypt ever was. When you rise up, when you speak out, when you lead people to freedom, they will find you, they will capture you, they will torture you, and they will kill you by crucifying you. And that one image, the one image of a Roman cross, is the ultimate symbol of death and destruction for the people to whom Jesus is speaking. How could anything salvific come from that? And yet, God's salvation is subversive. God's salvation takes those very symbols, those very means of death and destruction, and turns them upside down into life-giving, salvation-sending transformation and hope. I don't understand how that works. It's certainly not anything I can do. I try to think about the things in my life, the things in my life that seem destructive, that seem hurtful, that seem like they are hopeless ends, and to try to see how they could be turned into hope and opportunity and new life and salvation, I can't do that. That's why I need God. That's why I need faith. I can't take the problems, whether they are of my own creation or they are problems I find myself in or that is hardship in the world around me, I can't create a solution to those problems. I can't transform death into life. And that's why I need faith. That's why I need salvation, a salvation that comes from beyond me, because I can't do these things on my own. None of us can do these things on our own. And that's not to say that the death, even Jesus' death on the cross, is a good thing, that's great, any more than it would be to say that the snakes were a good thing. The example that came to me that I was really thinking of this week is treatments for cancer. Now, many of you are more medically wise than I am, but I know enough to know there are many different kinds of cancers. I don't just mean affecting different parts of the body, but they work in many different ways. And they impact the body in many different ways. And so there's not ever going to be one cure for cancer. Cancer's a group of diseases, and there's going to be a group of cures or treatments for a group of illnesses. But what I've noticed about the treatments for various forms of cancer is that those treatments almost always are in themselves deadly, right? Radiation is a deadly thing. Radiation sickness, radiation poison kills our body. But in a person who has cancer, when it's properly targeted, that method of death, radiation, can become an opportunity for life, can become that which brings healing. I have sat with someone, a woman I love dearly, as she received treatment for a particular cancer that she had. And what was dripping into her body from the little clear sac next to her was arsenic. Poison. Pure and simple. Poison that we create. Poison that we use to kill vermin. And yet what it was doing in her body was attacking specifically what was trying to harm her. And it was eliminating it. And it worked so far. It's been a few years, and as far as I know, that treatment has worked. How remarkable. And most astoundingly to me, I saw a video online a few months ago about a really radical treatment for a young girl who was dying, and they had tried every other treatment, every other drug and medicine and procedure they could think of, and they had no options left, and so the parents signed off on this really ridiculously impossible treatment, but it was their only hope. 5-year-old girl. They injected her body with mutated cells of the HIV virus. Now, the HIV virus attacks the immune system and kills the cells in our bodies that keep us healthy. How could this possibly do anything good? Well, this virus had been mutated just enough that it targeted and attacked not the immune cells, but the cancer cells. The girl's body went into shock. She lost consciousness. She slipped into a coma for several days. But they continued to monitor her, and they continued to keep her as comfortable and as healthy as they could. And by the time she came up out of that coma, almost all of the cancer cells in her body had been eradicated. Now, I was in elementary school in the 80s during the onset or the beginning of the AIDS crisis and scare, and you know, all the stuff about how you keep from contracting this frightening, horrible disease. If you had told any of us then that you could take AIDS cells or HIV cells and use them to treat or cure certain kinds of cancers, how ridiculous. I can't imagine ever saying that radiation or arsenic or HIV are good things, are things from God, that it's somehow okay to imagine that God created this suffering for so many people through the worldwide AIDS epidemic just so that we could find a treatment for one particular kind of cancer. And we run a risk when we say that. When we say that God, that suffering alone is from God and is therefore a good thing. But what I do know is that God is that power which is able to take the most painful, devastating, awful, death-dealing parts of our world, of ourselves, and transform them into salvation. It is, as the Apostle Paul says, true that nothing in life can separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus. There is not a thing beyond God's redemption, not a snake, not a cross, not a virus, and most certainly not a person. God's promise to us of salvation is the promise that is beyond ourselves, something we could not possibly do on our own. But the promise that all that is death-dealing, all that is painful and destructive can be subverted into salvation. Where are those places in your life where destruction seems to hold sway? And how is God even now working to bring transformation there, to bring salvation? I don't know. But I lift my glass to a God of that subversive salvation, and I say to you, salut, sote, to your health, to your salvation. Amen.